All right. Good morning and welcome. As you know, this argument is being held on Zoom. And so if at any time during this argument you have trouble hearing or we have trouble hearing you, we will let you know. As you know, each side has 15 minutes with the appellant having 5 minutes for rebuttal. With that, unless there's any questions, let's get going. So Marshall, do you want to call our first case?
Yes, Judge. Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Ross, and Judge Cochran. The Honorable Chief Judge Susan Siegel presiding. This is case A-20-1149, State of Minnesota versus Logan Philip Kirsch.
All right. Ms. Heinrich, go ahead and just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Laura Heinrich, and I represent the appellant, Logan Kirsch. Before I get started, as the court may be able to already perceive, I have a pretty bad head cold. So if anyone is having trouble hearing me, please interrupt me and let me know. I will do my best. Unreliable identification is an affront to due process and a leading cause in wrongful convictions. The eyewitness identification in this case was not reliable, and its admission at trial was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The district court erred in both steps of the analysis that the court considers in addressing the reliability of the eyewitness identification pretrial. That first step is where the court looks at whether or not the procedure used by the police officer was unnecessarily suggestive. The focus of that first step is what the police officer did. The second step is whether the witness has an independent recollection or its own memory that would somehow seal off that identification or make that identification reliable despite any police influence as to the suggestiveness of who to pick. For the first question here, we have Officer Sendelbach employing the most suggestive procedure that you possibly could, which is a show of yes.
Can I jump you to the second stage, the reliability factor? Courts are instructed in dealing with the reliability concern that there are five factors to look at, but that's not an exclusive list of factors. The question of reliability, it seems to me in this case, is actually part of the analysis the district court incorporated into the first stage, and I think probably should go into the second stage, and I'd like you to address it, which is this seeming connection. The victim here had three modes of identifying the defendant. One was through an account, through sort of textual references. Another is with the name associated with that account. And the other is the in-person observation. And it seems to me here you've got the police officer making a connection between the account with the incriminating statements and your client, and then an image from that connection matching the name, and all of that matching with the in-person or the identification, even though it may have been suggestive. So can you help me to understand why those multifaceted concerns, those circumstances, don't demonstrate this case is one of very significant reliability?
Let me make sure I'm addressing this in the way that you're asking me to. I think you're asking me to address it within the second prong, which is whether or not the witness has an independent recollection of what happened.
Well, no. The second prong is whether it's otherwise reliable, and the independent recollection is only part of it. So, if that's so, if you think I'm wrong about that, let me know. If I'm right about it, why aren't these other circumstances indicia of reliability?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I do think it's slightly different than the way that you're framing it. That second prong really is about the formation of the memory of a specific identification, which would have been who picked up the complaining witness, VK, on the night of July 8th. What what the police officer is trying to figure out is the person who picked her up, who then sexually assaulted her. The question is whether or not what she viewed, the circumstances she viewed, what her mindset was, all the other circumstances of that particular evening, whether or not she accurately formed a recollection of this individual who picked her up. These other ways of identifying who could possibly been, I mean, that's sort of background noise as to what actually happened on that particular night. Even if you were to take them into consideration that the police officer is doing an investigation, it's not about the accuracy of the police officer's investigation or what evidence they built that they tried to pick the appropriate suspect. The question is whether or not the influence of, well, in the first step, it's the influence of what the police officer is doing is ultimately influencing the eyewitness to pick this particular person. But as to the second step, it doesn't matter what the police officer is doing. You have an individual here who says that, well, in looking at the Snapchats between One Fish, Two Fish, Dr. Seuss, and VK, there are no Snapchats that actually happen on the night where the sexual assault is to have occurred. So in the search warrant from the police officer having gathered all of these communications, nothing is actually sent back and forth between July 7th and July 10th, which is the relevant period of time here. What he actually looks at are text messages or Snapchat messages that occurred on July 15th, which is after the fact. Secondly, they don't see any pictures that are exchanged back and forth within the Snapchat. So there isn't another way in which she's identifying the person associated with this One Fish, Two Fish, Dr. Seuss account, because there's no photograph that's associated with the One Fish, Two Fish, Dr. Seuss account. And third, this is a stranger identification. Ultimately, this is an individual who doesn't know this person from school or from other contacts or friends of friends. This is somebody who's engaging only through a social media account with essentially a stranger. And so the fact that there's an account that this person is exchanging information with is not about the identification of who was ultimately in that car with her on the night.
Just so we're clear, if I understand your argument correctly, the relationship between the name on the account, the name associated with the account, the name of your client, has, and the fact that your client himself is indeed associated with the account from which the incriminating comments about towards the victim were written, you're saying that has no bearing on either stage of the assessment about identification?
No, I think that that only has bearing on the stage in which this court is looking at whether or not this was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. I don't think it has bearing on the first part, which is about, this is where I think the district court went awry in its analysis, is that it talked about the strength of the police officer's investigation and his own formation in his mind that this is the person he thought had committed the assault, rather than looking at the strength of the complaining witness's own recollection, as well as whether or not in that particular setting where he's showing a show-up identification with a single photograph, whether or not she's identified him before, whether or not she's given lots of details, whether or not this is a person that she had met and identified in other situations. I mean, the district court is relying on State v. Taylor. And in Taylor, you have a complaining witness who identified the person by name, had seen them multiple times in the building, said it was a neighbor. It's not a stranger identification. Hence, what the police officer was doing was a confirmation, because essentially the complaining witness had already identified the person as the assaultant, and they were just confirming that this is the same Bigelow that he was talking about before. Here you have an individual who has ultimately only interacted with somebody via an account, has seen them.
If I could interrupt you just for a second. There's evidence in the record that she had accepted rides from him before. So how does that alter the analysis?
Your Honor, the record, there are two different records here. You have the record from the omnibus hearing, and then you have the record from the court trial, which was essentially a number of exhibits that were stipulated to and given to the district court. At the omnibus hearing, the only record is the testimony from Officer Sendelbach. There was nothing else that was provided to the court. There were no additional records. There were no other witnesses called. Even the picture that was showed to the complaining witnesses was not submitted as an exhibit. At the omnibus hearing, which is the record that I think matters for this analysis, there is nothing about the complaining witness having gotten rides from this person before. The only thing that's placed into the record there is the investigation that Officer Sendelbach had done, which included link, because that is what the state was doing, was trying to bolster how sure Officer Sendelbach was that he was presenting to this complaining witness who he thought to have committed the crime. So it was about his connection to a particular, this account to an IP address. And it was about ultimately whether or not she identified the photograph as being Logan. It wasn't about her connection to this individual from that night of the sexual assault, from any other communications. They didn't talk anything about that during the omnibus hearing. So it's just not a part of the record. And maybe
can I ask another quick question?
Of course.
So your position is that we cannot consider the evidence in the trial record, in the stipulated facts record?
Yes, Your Honor. In addressing first whether or not the district court erred in finding whether this was a violation of due process, I would note that the state suggests that this court can, in citing to Osterich, I'm sure I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, which is a non-precedential opinion, and it's from a footnote. And it basically says that we don't see, the court explains that, or that court explains that they didn't see anything that didn't allow them to do so. But that was specific to a situation where the complaining witness had testified at trial about the identification proceedings. And so they took into account what the eyewitness had testified to at trial. That did not happen here. You don't have any eyewitness testimony. You have no testimony at all. Everything that was submitted at the court trial was essentially police reports, search warrants.
Just so we're clear, at the omnibus hearing, we do have the information that I was referring to earlier, the information of the relationship between the account name, the holder of the account being your client, and the relationship between the account and the actual name of the of your client. So assuming that you are correct, that we do consider those factors as to harmless error, explain how it's not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the clear association between your client and the account and the victim and the account in identifying who the perpetrator was and the conduct of the perpetrator.
The question the court has to answer is not, well, let me first make sure that I'm articulating the harmless error standard correctly, and that it's the reasonable possibility that the evidence complained of contributed to the conviction, not whether it could have been convicted without the evidence. So if there's other evidence there that could have supported the conviction, it still has to be that it's not reasonable that the admission of this eyewitness identification would have influenced. So I'll start there, that it's very hard to find a situation where the only identification of who was there on the night of the sexual assault coming from VK wouldn't have had an influence on the district court's finding that Mr. Kirsch was in fact the person who sexually assaulted her. But I would also point out that even if the court were to interpret this evidence of the connection to the account as being particularly strong for identity, there are no Snapchat messages between the account and VK during the period of time where the sexual assault was meant to have occurred. And, there are these Snapchat messages from afterwards, and there's Snapchat messages from before, but there's nothing during that period of time. You also have within the record from VK that she was out of it a lot of the time during this period. She was running. She is a runaway from home.
Just so we're clear, the Snapchat messages would include visual. There's not just a text. There's an image of.
Correct. Oh, so that there is no image of my client that was Snapchatted between him and VK, just to be sure that the record is clear here. What the police officer did is in association with the One Fish, Two Fish account, there were other text messages, other people that are, sorry, Snapchat messages with other people that included a video that had an in-house known associate of Mr. Kirsch, like a friend who said the words, "Logan, we're killing you here." But that had nothing to do with any exchanges with VK. That was with somebody else. So there were no visual images that were exchanged between VK and Mr. Kirsch. But yes, if there had been any, that would have been part of what the police officer would have retrieved as part of the search warrant. He did retrieve all of the relevant communications between One Fish, Two Fish and VK's Snapchat account during that time period. I see that my time has almost expired, and I would reserve any additional comments for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Can I ask one quick question?
Ms. Heinrich.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Cochran.
I just wanted to let you know that I'd like to ask you about the five factors set forth in Ostrom during your rebuttal time.
Of course.
And if I could just inquire about,
please, go ahead.
About the companion case. As to the other issue that we weren't able to address during your oral argument, what is the status of that case?
Opinion, you're talking about the extended juvenile jurisdiction case that had, yes, been in a different. So that opinion was issued on April 5th. In that case, I think judgment has been entered at this point back into the district court. So it's no longer with the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Heinrich. And Mr. Zettler, go ahead. Just identify yourself for the record as you begin.
May it please the court. My name is Todd Zettler, and I represent respondent, the state of Minnesota. The district court in this case followed State versus Taylor. And in State versus Taylor, whether the procedure was unnecessarily suggestive states exactly this, and I quote, "Included in that inquiry is whether the defendant was unfairly singled out for identification." That is what brings in the strength of the police investigation. That is what, Judge Ross, I think you indicated seems somewhat counterintuitive, because some of those same factors would also come into play in the five factors in the second part of the test. But whether he was unfairly singled out for identification includes the police investigation and whether it was unfair. And as the court...
Oh, hold on. You know, there's a lot of different language that's used in this unfair question. One of them is whether it's unduly suggestive. That is, whether it was unnecessary to have the procedure that was used, and or whether the procedure that was used was unduly suggestive, was bearing upon the will of the impression of the witness. So, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it seems like the case law uses interchangeable terms that have different meaning, and courts seem to apply them differently in different cases. So what's your best assessment of how that first step is actually directing us to analyze the evidence of the district court? Should it be whether the procedure was necessary, whether the suggestibility of the procedure was unduly weighty? What exactly are we looking at in that first step?
I think really all of that. I mean, it's whether he was unfairly singled out for identification. And if you look at State versus Taylor, the Supreme Court was moved by the fact that Mr. Taylor in that case was identified as Bigelow, identified by name. They didn't pick a random person who matched the general physical description. They had specific information, and the name was important. And that is very comparable to what happened in this case when the victim knew that the defendant's name was Logan. They then followed Logan all the way down through the investigation. They knew that Logan used that Snapchat account. They traced that Snapchat account to the IP address at Logan's house. They had information that Logan lived there. They had sexually aggressive Snapchats from that.
But that was all after the fact, correct?
That was after.
But there was interaction. But can I just ask you this question just so I understand your position? So unfairly singled out and unduly suggestive, you're saying that's kind of a both and. So if Mr. Kirch was unfairly singled out, that could be a problem under the first prong. Or if the lineup itself was unduly, showing him the photograph, it wasn't a lineup, was unduly suggestive for identification purposes. That would be a problem under the first prong. Is that how you're helping us understand the law?
I think that's right.
Thanks. Okay. All right.
So was Taylor an outlier though? I mean, have you found any other cases that follow this approach, which is that, well, you've got the name of the, you've got some other way to associate the individual. It's not specifically or exclusively about the suggestibility, but it's about how the police came to that person and presenting that photo presenting that individual. Is Taylor an outlier? And if so, is Ms. Heinrich correct that really is a circumstance that should be left to some other part of the analysis, perhaps the harmless error part, but not certainly not the first stage?
Well, I think that when it is used and it's merely confirmatory, that it's appropriate to be used in that first circumstance. And I don't believe that Taylor is an outlier. I think that that's largely how it went in Oestreich. And I know that that's how it's gone in other cases as well.
So, Mr. Zettler, I want to follow up on that. My question for you, is there any recent case, precedential or non-precedential, that you think has a similar fact scenario to this one, where an appellate court has found that a single photo identification was not unduly suggestive? Because Taylor's a 1999 case.
Correct, from the Minnesota Supreme Court. So I think
that, right. And clearly it's something. Precedential, but I'm just wondering, you know, since then, have there been any cases that have a similar facts situation where a single photo was found to be not unduly suggestive?
I'm sure there are. I can't say that I've done a full look for exactly that issue. I think that it might be similar, and I'm trying to find the case here as I talk. State versus Jacobs, where the it's more of an independent basis. So on page 13 of the state's brief, the fact that J.E. had an independent basis to identify appellant, that she recognized him from her birthday party, makes it unlikely that her identification resulted in a suggestive circumstance from the jail website that ends EVU. So in that case, they had a name. They went on to the jail website. They found somebody who matched that name. The image matched, and that's how they then, that was part of how they identified them. But I have not done an extensive, exhaustive search for that exact question. And in this case, the district court followed State versus Taylor, and I think the district court was correct.
So can I add, you, in the omnibus hearing, the detective testified that this was a confirmatory identification, but there's nothing in law, there's no special exception or case law identifying something different about a confirmatory, correct? I mean, that just goes to these independent, that he wasn't unfairly singled out by the officer, that part of the argument, right?
Right, under Taylor and its progeny, when the court says it's confirmatory, that indicates that there is a strong police investigation leading up to this. This is not pulling someone off the street at random with bare information and saying, is this the guy?
That's the part that I'm troubled about. And I, I know, I mean, Taylor is precedent and we're bound by Taylor. I get that. But as a purely analytical perspective, whether something is unduly suggestive to an individual who is identifying a person or asked to identify a person, it seems to be wholly separate from how that photo came into the police universe. Why did the police choose that photo? To me, as a matter of logic, it seems to be irrelevant as to whether it's suggestive or not. So I think Ms. Heinrich, frankly, I mean, I'm not speaking for the panel, but it feels like Ms. Heinrich is correct in the analytical approach that courts ought to take. But Taylor seems to carve a different course, and we're bound by Taylor. So, but it is troubling to me. I'm not sure that Taylor is necessarily consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court had in mind with the two-step inquiry. But reversing Taylor is above our pay grade.
If we turn to the five factors under the totality of the circumstances and the five factors, what's your best argument that the district court's order should be upheld?
Well, and there's a couple of things in that regard. First, the Snapchat records are not complete. So when you hear that there's no photos, what there are, well, it is what it is, I guess I could say. Snapchat is everybody.
How do the Snapchat photos relate to the five factors in forgetting the name of the case, the five factors that we consider to under the totality of the circumstances. I know it's not an exclusive list, but I'm not clear how the Snapchat relates to any of those five factors.
Well, it would relate to the first fact, the first that we
oh,
have.
Oh, her. Just, I see.
And also to the last, that being the beyond harmless beyond reasonable doubt. But keep in mind, the Snapchat records, the Facebook records, they're not complete. They were obtained by search warrant, but they auto-delete, so they don't have all of them. So what they have are, they could see that pictures were sent back and forth. We don't have those pictures. We don't know what they were. So that's in the record, and that is what it is. We don't have everything. We were able to get what we could get. As far as the opportunity for exactly those five factors to determine whether there was a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification, the district court obviously found that there was not. I mean, first, the district court found that it was not an unnecessarily suggestive procedure, but second, that there was not a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. Opportunity to view perpetrator. The victim had an excellent opportunity to view the perpetrator. She was in the car with him all the way from Minneapolis to Shakopee. Degree of attention. He had her full attention when she woke up and he was sexually assaulting her.
Ms. Heinrich pointed out that earlier she had been under the influence of marijuana. Does that affect the analysis of the degree of attention?
I mean, that's certainly in there. And she was tired. She was sleeping. She woke up. That's what she said. So yes, that certainly factors into it. But here, when she woke up, he was at arm's length. We know that. And in the car, we know that as well. And he had her full attention. So that is what the district court had. Accuracy of description, it was generally accurate. Level of certainty, she was certain. There was no hesitation. And keep in mind also, she was shown multiple, I mean, I know the court is aware of generally how this case came about. This was not a single incident. The officer was investigating something like 8 separate criminal sexual conduct cases that came out of this episode. So there were multiple people involved. She did not identify everybody. So this was not like she was passively saying yes to everybody shown to her. And he was not throwing these photos saying, this is the guy. It was very, this may be him, this may not be him. Give me your thoughts. What do you think?
Well, this isn't a case, occasionally you have the show up where the officer is chasing someone, catches someone, and encounters the victim. You don't really have time to put together a lineup. It's not really reasonable under the circumstances. Here, there's none of that. Is there? There's no reason why the investigator didn't gather photographs. I mean, you could pull them on from online that were relatively close in appearance to the defendant to present a photographic lineup. How should that factor into our analysis, the fact that there was nothing inhibiting a more proper, thorough lineup?
Well, there's nothing requiring it either. So in the cases that you...
Well, there's nothing requiring except for a truckload of cases that say that single photo lineups are condemned and strongly discouraged. I think there's a lot that argues against it. We wouldn't be
here. I don't think that they've ever been condemned, and they certainly are prohibited. So the question is...
Actually, I think at least in one case, the word used was condemned.
Well, so in this case, though, did they create a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification when this wasn't the case like Taylor, for instance, where here's a person surrounded by police, handcuffed, obviously the guy that police think they have. That, to me, is more indicative of guilt than showing a single photograph of somebody not in custody, not in police booking photos, not handcuffed, simply dressed in business casual. Is this the guy? That's hardly the same thing as the show-ups with the police surrounded by vehicles and handcuffed.
No, it's not the same thing, but we still have plenty of... I can't think of a single case that suggests that a single photo lineup is recommended in any circumstance.
I'm not saying, and I'm not arguing that it's recommended. I'm arguing that it was did not create a substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification.
On the second issue, you're asking us simply to affirm the lifetime conditional release, but it seems like. But I'm curious about how the companion case and its resolution would bear upon what we do with that second issue.
The problem is that because there was no objection in the district court by the defense to how this to that issue, it wasn't a. This issue wasn't raised. Nobody put this before the district court. So the district court followed all the information given to it in the pre-sentence investigation and the sentencing worksheets and imposed the conditional release terms as required.
Now, but how does that companion case and the fact that that was appealed, how does the disposition, I haven't seen the disposition of that case. I'll certainly look at it. I'm sure we all
affirmed. It's affirmed.
But how does it bear upon the sentence? I mean, you're asking us to say, well, you would have gotten a lifetime conditional release term anyway, if it had been followed appropriately. If the execution of the EJJ sentence was the second rather than the first conviction, I think you're arguing that you still would end up with a lifetime conditional release. But wouldn't we be asking the district court to change that sentence in that case and not this case? And hasn't that case been appealed? So I'm just curious procedurally what we're supposed to do with it.
The state is prejudiced by the defense not having raised that issue. The state is very concerned with this defendant having a lifetime conditional release. If the court vacates the lifetime conditional release in this case, you would remand, presumably, for the district court to impose the mandatory 10-year conditional release period. In that instance, his previous sentence would become, I mean, he's in prison on that right now, would become an unauthorized sentence and subject to sentence correction. And I think that the lifetime conditional release could be placed on that sentence at that time.
But that case isn't before us, so we couldn't do it in this
correct.
Case, right?
That's correct.
So the remedy you asked for in your brief is not really one that we can give.
Because the cases were not consolidated, I think that's correct.
No matter how many times I do this, I forget to unmute. Any more questions from the panel of Mr. Zettler? All right, Ms. Heinrich, go ahead, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I wanted to point out in the discussion of Taylor that even in the language of Taylor, The court makes clear that ultimately the concern is whether the procedure used by the police influenced the witness identification of the defendant. That's a quote that's from Taylor on page 161. Taylor doesn't create a new standard by which this court would look at two different prongs. Every other case addressing the issue of first, whether the police conduct or police method of identification was unnecessarily suggestive, doesn't also look at this issue of unfairly singled out. The only time I could see that as being a relevant inquiry is the construction of a lineup. So the idea of being unfairly singled out in a lineup is where if you say you have a lineup of six people and every single one is wearing orange except for one person that's now blue. The police officer... You
know, your argument is compelling except for the fact that, I mean, Taylor does reason in the way that you're asking us not to. Taylor specifically says, the Supreme Court said that the victim singled out Taylor by name as her assailant. And then she goes, and then it goes on about the conversation, et cetera, et cetera. There's a, which would be something distinct from what you're asking us to do. You're saying that we should exclude that and only look at the suggestibility, which makes sense, I think, in the case law before Taylor, but Taylor is precedent and we're bound by it, aren't we?
Yes, Your Honor, but I think that specific fact in isolation actually misconstrues the facts in Taylor. This is her neighbor. She's seen this person multiple times. They're in the same apartment complex. She's identified him a bunch of times. So you ultimately have a situation where this is not a stranger identification. This is a person that's known. That's why there's a conversation about being confirmatory. She already knows who this person is. She's seen him multiple times. It's a person in her building. It's a person she knows. They just want to make sure that the person in the building whose name is the same as what she's identifying is the person that she knows. So it's different in that sense. Factually, it's not just a name that's provided. And here you have essentially a stranger identification where ultimately the conversation has been only over Snapchat. They don't know each other from being in person. They don't know each other from the way that they look. They don't have a common community. They're not living in the same apartment complex.
Ms. Heinrich,
Go ahead, Your Honor.
If we move on to the next step and consider the totality of the circumstances and whether the totality of the circumstances establish independent reliability, other than the, and there's a non-exclusive list of five factors in Ostrom, other than the second factor, which I understand your argument on, is that enough to suggest that under the totality of the circumstances, her identification was not independently reliable?
Your Honor, I think that a lot of what the district court relies on are assumptions rather than facts found. If you look at the list of facts in the findings of facts section, nothing talks about this issue of them having had a conversation, of assuming that they must have looked at each other. Those are all sort of extrapolations that the court makes in their analysis and the legal part. And to the extent that this court would interpret those as fact-finding, I'd say they're clearly erroneous because they're not supported by the record. The state did not present any evidence that the two of them had a conversation. They didn't present any evidence about the time of day, though if you look at the trial court record, this was sometime like early in the morning, so like 1 or 2 in the morning where it's dark outside. All of the evidence about the degree of attention, for instance, is that she was out of it, that she'd smoked a lot of marijuana, and that she was asleep. So this idea that
not disputing that she woke up and was able to give a description of the person who assaulted her.
So I think that speaks to two of the factors, opportunity to view and accuracy. So the opportunity to view, the court makes a sort of assumption that there was more than a few moments, but we don't know how long she was asleep or how much she interacted with the individual who was in the car. And the accuracy, it's a pretty generic description. I see that my time is about to lapse. May I finish the answer to the question?
Yes, please.
So the accuracy, it's a pretty generic description of a white person in their early 20s with blonde hair and blue eyes. We know that Mr. Kirsch doesn't even have blonde hair. He has brown hair, and there's no suggestion that ultimately there's been any modification of his hair color. And the last factor for certainty, she does identify him, but ultimately, if you look at the transcript from the contested omnibus hearing on pages 23 and 24 about the certainty that this is the individual who was the perpetrator, that's asked of whether the police officer was certain, not whether she was. She was never asked, are you certain this is the person who was in the car with you on that night and who sexually assaulted you? And as we know from Hennepin County and the site that I have to the study that was done with Amy Klobuchar and Nancy Stablai, part of the preferred method of conducting any type of identification is you ask the witness their certainty at the end, because that, if you ask them their certainty and they provide that information, that is a factor to consider, but that was not done here.
For all of the reasons, so you're, I'm sorry.
That's preferred, but it's not absolute. If a police officer testifies that the impression of the officer from the identification was the certainty of the identification as expressed in whatever terms they were expressed to the officer, that's something the district court certainly can consider. Are you saying it can't consider that goal?
It could have, had this police officer been asked their opinion as to the certainty of the individual. But what's actually asked of him at the hearing was his own certainty that he had the right person. So he wasn't actually asked. He was asked if she immediately identified him, and she said yes. But in terms of the certainty portion, they're putting a lot of, the district court is putting a lot of weight on the fact that she didn't waver, but she also wasn't asked. The certainty is really about the police officers.
And so it's your view that when the officer says, this is the officer, it might not be him, this might be might be completely wrong guy, so just kind of give me your thoughts when you look at this guy. That's a quote, not me adding ums. And then she says, that's him. And then the officer says, that's Logan. And she says, mm-hmm, yes. So you're saying that her second response is not indicating certainty or confirmation?
So first, to be clear, that was not introduced at the omnibus hearing. That's from a transcript that was part of the trial exhibit. So just to be clear, I know that the state did have footnotes referencing those things in their argument, but that wasn't part of the record that was presented. Also, the issue is not whether or not she said yes. I mean, ultimately, she said yes. She was just not asked her level of certainty, which is the procedure that you would follow. And the police officer was never asked, did she come across as being certain? Did she? And nothing about her demeanor. So that's not part of the record. Basically, you just have that the police officer was certain that he had identified the correct person.
And you're saying we can't draw any inferences from the transcript because that was not presented during the omnibus proceeding, only the trial?
Yes. And I would point just even to XL Rasmussen. At the point that the defense has noticed an issue that's a constitutional significance, it's the state's burden to provide at the hearing the relevant evidence to try to prove that the Constitution hasn't been violated. In this case, the state focused almost exclusively on the police conduct. They didn't bring in any of the other things that the court would need to consider. They failed to meet their burden there. And at this point, they can't rely on trial exhibits that were never addressed. There was no cross-examination at the trial exhibits. There was no closing arguments in this case. This was sort of a strange hybrid of Rule 23.03 and Rule 26.03 and Rule 26.04 of the Minnesota Rules of Criminal Procedure, and that they were doing a court trial, but they didn't do any of the other protections, and he waived all of his rights sort of in a almost like a Lothenbach or a type of manner, which is not exactly.
But that in and of itself is not really relevant, because Kirsch stipulated to that record. So I mean, that absolutely. if we were to consider it, and, you know, that's something we'll have to figure out, we take it as it is because it's stipulated.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I just think it goes to the issue of what could be considered from the trial. You know, this outlier non-precedential case that refers to the trial testimony as being something that could be considered just because there was no sense that they couldn't, is a situation where the complaining witness did testify, had cross-examination, and testified specifically to the identification. Okay. So for all of the reasons presented in my brief and anything I didn't address today, I would still argue are relevant to the analysis. We'd ask that you reverse the district court's decision and find that this was not harm beyond it. This is not harmless or beyond a reasonable doubt.
All right. Thank you both for your arguments. They were very well presented.